Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
And this is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper. It's Sunday, November 11th, 2018, Veterans Day. Hats off to the veterans.
Yes, and we have a special guest star.
Sadie Eleanor Abuhoff.
Our middle child. Our only daughter.
I would like to say your most popular guest star, your most frequent guest star.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say our favorite child. That's what you usually say.
Well, that's, you know...
Anyway, Sadie and I have just returned from our annual excursion to Mohonk Mountain House. Now, we've talked about Mohonk many times before, so there's no need to really explain. It's a 149-year-old resort.
Mountain resort.
Mountain resort in
New Paltz, New York.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which everyone says, where's New Paltz? And I say, it's near Poughkeepsie. And if you don't know Poughkeepsie... you're out of luck.
Yeah, God save you. But anyway, it was chilly. It was beautiful. We had many adventures. We did quite a lot of eating. We got up, went to continental breakfast. Then we went to regular breakfast.
Right, back to back. No activities between.
Right, and we even did a little bit of hiking. Then went back to brunch.
Yep.
And, you know.
Don't forget the hot tub visits. And
hot
we
tub
did,
visits.
We did read an article that said 30 minutes in the hot tub burns more calories than a 30-minute walk. So there you go.
So we have been burning calories like there's no tomorrow.
Really?
I thought the hot tub excursion this year was a little problematic.
Yeah.
Well, the hot tub's always interesting because it's a large hot tub. It probably fits about, my guess would be like 12 people at max.
If you're good friends.
Yeah. It's like a clover shape, so there's like different little alcoves in it.
Yeah. And this time, so Sadie and I, it's in the spa. The spa at Mohonk was the first new construction in almost 100 years. And it's wonderful. And it gets a lot of use. But you can also get a day pass at great personal expense to the spa, which allows you to use the hot tub. It's this hot mineral pool outside.
And outside?
Yeah. So it's really wonderful. Yeah. And especially if it happens to be a full moon night.
Yeah.
So it gets dark at like 5 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll take our last dip around 6 and, you know, be out there with the stars and the moon, etc. But so we take dips in the hot tub in between all these hiking.
Throughout the day to get our money's worth, really.
Right.
But this time there were rather a few couples.
Mm-hmm.
They're for various things, like couples massage.
Mm-hmm.
Or like anniversary weekends.
Right. And we've been there with couples before, but you know, a hot tub can excite certain romantic tendencies. And these couples were kind of smooching up a storm.
Really?
So it was a little odd to be the mother-daughter combo next to all of this romance.
Yeah, I think in the past, it's been a more crowded hot tub, perhaps.
But also
so they've been
more
forced,
sociable.
Yeah, they've been forced to be more social, and it would be awkward if they're like making out in the corner. But this time it was like us and two couples, so they kind of had license to make out in the corner.
And I think they pursued it with great enthusiasm in the hope that
we would leave.
Tamsin would leave.
But that didn't work.
Well, we did eventually,
We left. It was, so.
Oh, that's not
so there was that.
In the midst of that, we planned our entire Thanksgiving meal, so that's all done.
Right.
We discussed every dish, every side dish, and every excursion during the Christmas vacation. So
this is not the wholesome Mohonk.
It was more productive for us than it was for them. Let's just put it that way.
But we took many nice hikes out in the elements, in addition to being in the hot tub in the elements, and we really had a lot of fun. It's still beautiful. It's still magical, no matter what else happens. Actually, it was also under construction.
Yeah, you told me.
They are enlarging the kitchen.
Right.
And there were some challenges in terms of food preparation and delivery, but we had a great time.
All right. Great.
And we made it back.
Yes, it was kind of a nice weekend.
And you were all on your own.
I was on my own.
Somehow you survived.
I did, yes. Okay, chess. And we haven't talked a lot about chess. Big chess tournaments coming up. The World Championship, one might say. And the competitors are The reigning champion, Magnus Carlsen of Norway.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about Chess the Musical.
No. Magnus Carlsen of
Chess the Game?
Yes. Magnus Carlsen of Norway is being challenged by American Fabiano Carobana.
Doesn't sound American.
Well, it's a good reason, perhaps, but his parents were Italian, or at least his mother is Italian. His plan was this. They came over. He was actually born in the United States, and he showed a lot of promise early on, even as a very young 4-year-old, 5-year-old, 6-year-old. And they decided, they being his parents, that they had to choose between school and chess. And they chose chess. And that meant that they went back to Europe because you couldn't be, in their view, trained as a grandmaster that was challenged for the world championship in the U.S. You had to go to Europe to do
that. So where did they go?
They went to Italy, I believe.
Italy is a grandmaster site?
They went to all kinds of places, really. But it's a European sport more than anything else.
Oh, I think of it as more like Russian, Eastern European.
Yeah, that's true.
Am I wrong?
No, you're not entirely wrong. But the truth is that he's basically been playing all over Europe for years and years and years. And
he's a super chess star in Europe.
Yes, but he came back to the U.S. First of all, he goes by Fabby now, so we don't have to call him Caruana. And he came back to the U.S. For one main reason, that somebody, a zillionaire, started a chess club and funding all these players in St. Louis. So the St. Louis Chess Club has emerged, and St. Louis has emerged as the center in the U.S. for chess. So
that's interesting.
So he came back to join the group in St. Louis. But there are two things that have sort of supported the notion that, in fact, you could have a supporter from the U.S. So, yeah, just confirm this. He was playing for the Italian Chess Federation. He did go to Italy. The two reasons that have greased the skids for American players are, number one, the St. Louis group, and number two...
Money.
No. So much of it is online. Whereas before, the kind of only way that you can get coaching was to be in person. Now, a lot of the information is done, set out by algorithms, which set out all the choices before you. You get your coaching by Skype. You have all these games that you have access to. You're able to play via the internet. He says he plays 50 games a night, 70 hours a week. You don't have to be where all the action is entirely. So it justifies his move back to the U.S., and he's considered a pretty normal guy as these things go. He's not another Bobby Fischer. He's considered to have a decent chance, although Carlsen's a great champion. They're both very young.
His name is Magnus.
It's Magnus, but Norway has no tradition with respect to chess. They're now very interested in chess because of this guy. He came from nowhere.
And you said there was something interesting about the article?
Yes, all of this is interesting.
Are we getting to it?
Yeah, we got to it.
Oh, okay.
The point is, what's interesting about it is that it's become so technological now that, like everything else, given the algorithms and all the...
I wouldn't say that's interesting. I would say that's depressing.
And here's the point. The point is that, it's a young man's game, more than ever. So he's 26, mm-hmm. Carlson's 27. In their view, the window's closing on them. They're not going to hang around until their 40s. It's not the idea.
So it used to be a more mature person's game?
Not necessarily, but it always did favor the energy that you need with a younger person. But now that's become even more the case.
It just tickles me because you remember not that long ago, your dad in his 90s beating Granger in chess.
What I remember is that my dad bought a book. In his 90s, say, how to improve your chess game. And I said to him, really? And he said, well, it couldn't hurt. And I said, it probably can. No, I think my main point here is it is entirely more mathematical now. It is very easy to bring up with all these computer sources the range of alternatives at any position on a board before you and study them. And we're not very far from getting to the point where a computer really would be the best possible chess player, though we're not at that point
yet. So you can basically sit in your basement in your underwear and be a chess master.
You can learn to be a chess master. Okay. You can't be a chess master. But you have the resource available to you that weren't before, and he's the first one to take advantage of it in the United States. We'll see. Right.
Well, one of the big sections in the New York Times this weekend was an entire separate section called Thanksgiving Pies. Sadie, did you look at it?
I did look at it, yes.
And so what's your reaction to the New York Times take on Thanksgiving pies?
I think it's extremely ambitious for a lot of people who barely even make Thanksgiving dinner. They're going to make a crazy pie with a crazy fancy lattice topping that's different than the normal. I don't know. I just think it's a little bit...
Well, what are we talking about? What kind of pies are they talking about?
I think it's super crazy. First of all, pie is one of the great things in life, okay? Any normal pie, wouldn't you say?
Right.
People don't make a basic pie on a regular basis, okay?
Yeah.
So we are starved for basic homemade pie, and I don't care what, and you can get the best, what you think is the best farm stand pie, and there's still nothing like a good pie.
But they want you to make
it. Okay? But here they're giving you a bunch of recipes: berry apple butter pie, citrus custard pie, two-tone ginger custard pie, change the apple ombre color effect, striped berry pie, sweet potato meringue, and cranberry herringbone, which is really basically what Sadie is calling the classic lattice.
Right. The herringbone doesn't look anything like a herringbone. It just
looks like lattice.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm old school. I think pie, a simple pie is a great
Well, this is thing. The problem that we have, and we discussed this in the hot tub. We have a backlog of pies right now.
Does this make it more interesting that you discuss it?
Yes.
We got so many pies.
We have a backlog of pies.
We want to eat.
Because for Thanksgiving,
listen, that's, you know, we don't need to talk about that. But
that's not what they were using their mouths for.
No.
Oh, my God. God, what?
So we're obviously going to make a pumpkin pie and an apple pie for Thanksgiving. Duh.
Right.
Yeah. We know that's happening.
We can't make pecan pie because we don't have enough people to eat it.
We don't have a lot of calories.
That's pecan pie must be the highest density of calories per bite.
Yes. And sugar.
So for, you know.
But then... we said, you know, who doesn't love a chocolate cream pie? We haven't made that in a while, so that's on the list.
Right.
If Boston cream pie counts as a pie, I mean, pie is in the title.
Yeah, we saw that. The Wall Street Journal had a big article about Boston cream pie.
They're calling it a pie. That's,
I've been saying literally for years that we need to make a Boston cream pie, and we haven't done that recently.
That is a great thing.
So, we have a backlog of pies that have to be made. And I think unless you're having, like, a 20-person, or which people do, like a 20-person Thanksgiving... how do you get to this depth of pie?
Can you make pies a day in advance? That's not allowed?
Some of them you can.
Yes,
some of them are best warm out of the oven.
It's kind of the same issue as like the crescent rolls. It's like you have to have the crescent rolls. So anything you do on top of the crescent rolls is going to be in addition to. Yeah. You can't like not have a pumpkin pie and then have like a apple ombre pie.
Right.
You need to cover your bases first. And then you get extracurricular.
People are going to walk in and say, you know, where's the apple pie? And you're going to say, oh, but we have berry apple butter pie.
Nobody wants that.
No.
All right. So you've blown the lid off the time.
Listen, that's like
Planet New York City or whatever.
Yeah. Once everyone can make a pumpkin pie from scratch, then we can talk about this stuff.
All right. You guys
but
came down.
Talking school. Of Thanksgiving,
I mean, you know,
makes you feel football is in the air.
Yes, football is in the air. No, I'm just remembering that Waitress movie that we saw. They were making all kinds of crazy pies in that Waitress movie.
Well, yeah, you know what? Her job was to make pies.
That's a point.
So she made pies.
I see. All right.
Dad doesn't miss a thing.
No.
You think he's snoozing in the Lazy Boy.
No.
But he's catching on.
He is.
To every nuance.
Football. Hampton wants to hear about football. Maybe this will interest you more than chess, Hampton. This is more up your alley. It's a little less intellectual. Here we go. Football. And there's an article, and this. I'll ask you, Sadie, about this. I always wondered what level of conversation goes on between the referees and the players during the game. And, you know, the referees obviously calling the fouls, calling the penalties, and they affect the game a great deal. But, you know, what I thought was happening when you were playing, even in eighth grade, was that the referees were talking to the players to some degree and giving them kind of counseling advice, Sadie's nodding, that they would say, don't do this, I'm going to have to call this, I'm going to have to call that. There'd be a little back and forth like that, a little almost coaching on the part of the referees.
Which we know is a no-no in some sports.
But not in football. It turns out that's what the referees are doing. The referees, although this is not picked up by the microphone, are actually saying to the players, watch it. Don't push off there. This is a quote. I don't want to have to get you for this the next time. Go easy. They're giving warning, and it's called preventative officiating. They're supposed to be doing that. They're telling the players when they're lining up wrong so they don't get that kind of penalty. I had no idea that kind of dialogue was going on.
Did you guys sense that at all?
That's I thought they were talking about fashions for the fall.
No, but seriously, I mean, it's a different thing than I realized. It's a different relationship. And it makes
you look
sense.
At Serena differently now, doesn't it?
It does make you look at Serena differently because that's not the relationship.
No, it wasn't
she
the
had.
Serena thing. Who was?
No.
The referee coaching. The player. Right. That was one of the male players.
Well, yes, you're right. You're right about that. There are two different
Nadal
things.
Nadal was complaining about.
Federer was complaining.
Well, first of all, just so we're clear, because we got 19 things confused. It wasn't even a match that Federer was in, but he was commenting on it. Right. And there was one of the players who's kind of a nutcase, frankly, was going crazy and doing very poorly. And the referee sat him down and talked him down over a 10-minute, calmed him down, encouraged him, and he went out and won the match. And there is a rule, and this is where the Serena thing comes in, against any kind of coaching during a match.
From refs or anybody, from
coaching or refs. And Federer pointed out that this was a violation of that rule. That rule was also violated in the Serena match by her coach.
Right. Well, so I've been watching a lot of hockey recently, and it's clear in the hockey games that the refs have a relationship with basically every single person on the team and on the bench. They're seeing these people, you know, several days a week, all year long.
Yeah.
So it's not so much that they're giving them warnings before plays. They know literally every player by their first name, and the players know them by their first name. So, and it's a little back and forth of like, hey, like, are you going to call this? Like, are you going to miss that call every time? And then the refs being like, no, like, this is what I'm doing, and that's why I didn't call that. And they'll have these conversations throughout the game.
That's good. That's the same kind of thing. Well, I think that's what's going on in football. It's interesting that you notice that in hockey. And they do make the point, well, they quote this fellow, Gene Steratore, who you hear on television now. He's a retired ref, and he's a commentator. And he said that when he retired just this last year from officiating, he got a note in the mail from a player saying how much he enjoyed the games that the referee, Gene Steratore, was in, and it was a great experience that they shared. And the question is, who was the former player who wrote that note to Gene Steratore?
I do not know.
Peyton Manning. Who else would write that note?
Because he's a classy guy. But anyway, it's clear to me that they are a piece of the puzzle when it comes to professional sports. And they see these people like those are their colleagues at work.
You think that happens in basketball as well?
I think so.
I think it does happen in all sports. Look, there's no game without the referees.
I mean, come on, the umps and the catchers, they're probably showing up at each other's baby showers.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably right. But so here's something about basketball, which also goes back to your eighth grade experience, and even my eighth grade experience, or even earlier than that. The NBA has a setup now with respect to the All-Star team. That's this. The top vote getter in the East and the West pick the teams. In other words, they pick the All-Star rosters are voted in. You've got 24 players, but there's going to be 12 on each side. But the 24 or 22 are in the
players?
Group. Top two players picked from among the remaining 22 as if they were
just like second grade.
Just like second grade.
They've done that in the NHL before.
But here's the problem with that. They ran into. They started doing that a couple of years ago. Well, at first they were going to televise the actual picking.
Yeah.
And the union said, no, don't do that. And they said, why not? Because it's embarrassing to the guy who's picked last.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so this has been going on for a year or two, even as the league and to some degree the television say, no, we really want to televise this. Mm-hmm. And finally, they came back to the union on this and some of the players said, you know, come on. You're in the top 24 players right. in the entire world.
You're making
world.
Millions of dollars.
How can it be embarrassing? And they eventually relented. But they said that really was the reason. They didn't want to embarrass anybody. And they have a quote here from Horford, Tito Horford, who was the last player taken last year. And he said he's for it also. They should be transparent. He says, guys have to understand, just because you're being picked last out of 24 players, they're the 24 best players. At the end of the day, what having fun reminds me, this is Horford talking, it reminds me back in the day when you were in the schoolyard and you were picking teams. Maybe you would have taken it harder than to be picked last, but now? Come on.
Well, this is the thing. These are all the guys who were picked first in the schoolyard.
That's right.
So at this point, they should be over it. But also, they've done that in the NHL before, and I will say, I don't think they do it necessarily based on straight-up skill.
Yeah.
Like, they might be the first couple rounds, but oftentimes, like, there are already friendships and, like,
right.
even relatives that are picking. Like, there's one family, the Stahl brothers, that have four brothers in NHL. Right. So, like, if one of the Stahl brothers is the captain, he's going to pick his brother last.
Yeah.
You know, it's, like, stupid stuff like that. It's not necessarily the worst player goes last. It's, like, little rivalries and pranks going
on. But there's teammate issues, too, even in the NBA. But it is kind of funny that even when you get to that level, it took 2 years to get past this rule. Because people say they still remember when they were like 9 years old and they didn't get picked.
But none of those people got picked last. All of those people got picked first.
Apparently, they have a sensitivity that you wouldn't expect. All right, Tamsin, the Minotaur.
Yes. Art update.
Yes.
The residents of Toulouse, as in France.
Yeah.
Toulouse, France, were treated to the sight of a 50-foot tall mechanical Minotaur.
Right.
Coming down the street. And it was all part of a sort of a performance by a group called La Machine, headed by François de la Rosière, telling the story of the Minotaur. And apparently it strolled through Toulouse on November 1st, pulled along by some 16 technicians, and he even made kind of a breathing noise. And the next day came Act Two, where there was also a spider, and they were telling this whole story of the Minotaur and Ariane. And it turns out to be Ariane is the French version of Ariadne. And so you know the story of the Minotaur, don't you?
Say yes, Sadie, quickly.
Of course.
I'm sure you don't remember it in its entirety.
So we're going to hear it now.
Yes. Well, who can resist? Remember King Minos.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a great story, too, but I won't go into it.
This is only a 45-minute program.
Okay. Anyway, King Minos of Crete his dad was Zeus, his uncle Poseidon gives him the gift of a fabulous bull to be sacrificed to Poseidon, okay? Unfortunately, everybody on Crete falls in love with the bull.
As you do.
And they don't want to sacrifice it.
As you do, right?
In Greek mythology, people are always falling in love with the bull. And so everybody falls in love with it, especially Mrs. Minos, whose name is Pasiphae. Maybe you've heard of her. Okay, she is really in love with the bull.
It's like one of those hot tub stories, right?
One of those hot tub stories. Yeah. She goes to the Daedalus. Remember Daedalus? Like Daedalus and Icarus? He's the like court engineer / magician / can-do guy.
Right.
And she goes to Daedalus and she says, Daedalus, please, 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 please. Can you make me a costume, like a cow costume, so I can get a little closer to this bull? And he says, really? Really? And she says, yes, please, 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 please.
This is a family program.
He does. Yeah. He does. She does indeed get to know the bull better.
Yeah.
And in a few months, she gives birth to the Minotaur,
mm-hmm.
half man, half bull.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and Minos, you know, Minos being kind of a half-breed himself is cool with this. They keep the Minotaur. It's kept in the labyrinth. Remember the labyrinth? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, the whole idea is he's safe there. He can't escape, and people can't get to him either. But the thing is, he's got to eat. A Minotaur's got to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And so Minos has some disagreements with Athens, and next thing you know, Athens has to send, I think it's like 6 young men and 6 young women every year to Crete to feed the Minotaur.
Mm.
Well, along comes Theseus. That's a long story too. Son of the king of Athens. And he says, Dad, we got to do something about this. We can't keep sending our best young people to be eaten by the Minotaur. And he says, Dad, I will go and I will kill the Minotaur. And so he sails off to Crete with all the other sacrificial victims. And he says, and when I come back, Dad, I'm sailing off. I've got black sails up. Okay. If I succeed, I will change those sails to white sails.
Mm-hmm.
But if I don't, it will still be the black one. So you know, the minute you see my ship, you know the result. Okay, because they didn't have
cell phones.
Cell phones. Right. Okay, so he goes to Knossos. He actually gets into the labyrinth, and what do you know? There's Ariadne. Ariadne is one of the daughters of King Minos, falls immediately in love with Theseus, and says, Theseus, you know, I could help you with this. And he says, really? You know, if you like, loved me, I could be very helpful. Do you love me, Theseus? He says, oh, do I love you? I said, as soon as this is done, I'll take you with me and we'll go off forever into the sunset. So she gives him a ball of string with the idea of, in the maze, you unroll the string, right? And then when you're done, you can find your way out by re-rolling the string. So, in fact, he does kill the Minotaur. He's thrilled. Ariadne's thrilled. They go off. They stop at the first island to take a rest. And next thing you know, Theseus has taken off on the ship without Ariadne. He has just dumped her there. Hmm. Some people say Athena interfered with this. But anyway, don't worry about Ariadne. Because guess who marries her?
Who?
Dionysus! Dionysus!
Thank goodness.
I mean, it's a little bit weird, because he is the god of orgies and altered states.
Yeah.
Just one more part of it.
Yes.
Okay.
Why?
On his way home, he's coming home, he can see the cliffs. King, his dad, is out there on the cliffs looking for him, sees the ship. They forgot to change the sails.
Oh, really?
And he is so upset, so bereft, that his son has been eaten by the Minotaur, that the whole thing has not succeeded, that he throws himself off the cliff.
Oh, that's a happy ending.
Can you throw yourself off a cliff, or do you just jump?
Yeah, I think
it's
you
a
can
little bit
yourself.
Of both. Yes. I think that is throwing yourself off. So there you have the story of the Minotaur, and it sounds like a fun time with this parade in Toulouse.
So, that was it's quite the story. It's quite the story, and it's sort of relevant to our next bit, which is about dramas being shortened on television. There's long and there are short versions. That was the short version, right? But in any event...
Are you intimating that that was the long version?
I don't know which it was.
Well,
but
we're about to talk about 30-minute programs.
Well, here's the point.
Which this is not.
A very, very simple point that the reviewer, James Ponswick, is making in the New York Times, saying he's into 30-minute shows. He's saying, you know, 30-minute dramas in particular, that used to be that the people doing dramas assumed, particularly on cable, that you had to have an hour-long show to make it weighty, to make it more interesting, to make it worth people watching. But increasingly, there are 30-minute shows, including Homecoming with Julia Roberts. And he says that's the way to go. Why? Because, first of all, it's much more practical. It's very hard. He said, look, it's not about me. I review shows for a living. But some people have actual productive lives. They don't have time at any time in the world to sit down for an hour-long show. If you've got a 30-minute show, they're more apt to give it a shot. And
that's
just more practical.
That's absolutely our experience.
And that's what we do.
We often end up watching Mozart in the
Jungle.
Mozart
in the Jungle because it's 30 minutes.
Because it's very short. It's small bites.
Right.
I don't even know if it's 30 minutes, but it's a beautifully crafted 30 minutes or whatever
it is. It's easier to commit to it as opposed to. He said the other thing about 30-minute shows is, you know, when you're in a new show or you're thinking a new show, you got to size it up to see if you're going to invest in it. And if you watch a 30-minute segment, you can. If you have to watch an hour-long segment or two, people aren't going to try it. I mean, or they might be more reluctant to try it, even to size it up.
Is it because we're just stupider and our attention spans are less?
No. He says that's not at all. As a matter of fact, he thinks some of the shows are drawn out more than they have to be because they think that they have to use up the time. The other point is a plotting point. He said a lot of people feel that the way to go in these shows is to make it more complicated, the more and more subplots and characters. He says that's not necessarily advantageous. A lot of the shows are much more focused and much more interesting with a simple plot with a limited number of characters, and that actually adds to the drama, and again, that lends to a shorter segment of 30-minute shows.
Okay, on that note, I'm moving on to Dog Hikers.
Well, let me just ask Sadie first quickly. Preference for 30-minute shows or hour-long shows, Sadie?
I can't say that I watch any 30-minute shows. but I'm not opposed to them. I typically watch hour-long shows, but...
All right.
Dramas.
Yeah.
But your shows, like your HGTV shows, aren't those are 30 minutes.
I don't sit down at like 8 o'clock on, you know, Thursday night to watch that. That's like, if it's on, I watch it. But yeah, I am mostly hour long shows and I don't watch a lot of dramas.
Okay. All right. So we've got that covered. Dog Hikers. May I go on now, please, sir?
Yes.
Article in the New York Times today about another new aspect of this gig economy, the dog hiker.
Yeah.
And it was, as you might expect, a lot of dogs in New York don't get enough exercise. Now, we know that people in New York and other places who work will hire dog walkers, mm-hmm. right? Somebody comes to your apartment, gets the dog, takes them out for a little walk, maybe twice a day while you're at work. But some dogs seem to need more than that. And so they will be picked up by a company like My Dog Hikes, which was founded by Andrea Klein, who's 33 years old. And she and an assistant pick up the dogs at various locations in Manhattan, load up as many as like 14 dogs into a car and drive out to Jersey or upstate for an off-leash hiking experience. Yeah. Now, here's some interesting things about it. So she's a dog trainer. She understands how to handle the dogs, because it seems a little nerve-wracking, doesn't it? The idea that your dog will be off-leash, away from home. Will you ever see it again? But they are each provided with a waterproof GPS, GPS tracker. So that they can find the dogs. She also insists that they be on anti-tick medication.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
That's really important.
Yeah.
And that they also be capable of following certain commands. And she won't take the dogs if they're aggressive. They need to get along with other dogs. But it seems, to really fill a void. It's interesting, all these dog pet related businesses there are now. Dog walkers, dog sitters, now dog hikers, and they go out for a vigorous, hike.
Well, it's good for the dogs, right?
They say the dogs lose weight. They have a quote from one owner who says, he's so much more fit now, he has that sexy waist back. And they seem to improve in terms of, sociability, and they seem happier as well. So think about that.
All right. Okay. Here's something that I don't want to spend too much time on, but because a lot of people have been talking about it for a long time, but there's one interesting aspect of it, and that is who's going to win the Cy Young Award for the best pitcher in the National League. The reason that you've heard a lot about it is because the leading contender, perhaps, is Jacob deGrom of the New York Mets.
Well, it's got to be him, right?
Well, no, it doesn't have to be him.
Well, but he's done so well, even though he's on such a crappy team. Well,
and he cut his hair this year, didn't he?
He did, yes. Those are two very compelling reasons to choose him for the Cy Young Award. But beyond that, the issue, just to frame it, is that sort of the converse of what Thompson just said. He hasn't been able to win very many games. He only has 10 wins, which is not very good. He'd like to have the leading pitcher in the league have close to 20 wins. And he has very good statistics otherwise, but it's very rare, almost unprecedented, to give it to a pitcher who has so few wins, because a pitcher goes out there to win the game. Now, the reason is that the Mets haven't been good, and you can justify his lack of wins by the Mets' performance, but it's just not the way the Cy Young Award normally goes. So here's what's interesting about it. I mean, he has competition from Max Scherzer and Aaron Nola. Scherzer of the Nationals, Nola of the Phillies, in particular Scherzer. Scherzer is close to 20 wins and has very good statistics besides, but not quite DeGrom's. And the way it's been discussed throughout the year is DeGrom has the lowest earned run average. He gives up the fewest runs per nine innings, and as opposed to Scherzer, has all those wins. Back and forth debate. What's interesting about it is if DeGrom wins it, normally that debate would be resolved if they give it to Scherzer, because his statistics are close enough to DeGrom's in many areas, and
he's got the wins.
But here's what's different now. What's different is they don't have just merely the two or three normal ways of measuring performance because of the statistical influence on baseball now. They've come up with three or four or five different ways to measure performance. So I'm staring at a piece of paper which doesn't have four numbers on it, but it has 19 numbers on it and 19 bases of comparison. There are things like adjust the ERA, which adjusts the earned run average according to the ballpark you're pitching in, win probability added, how much does the pitcher add to the probability that the team's going to win a particular game, fielding independent pitching, basically how should their pitching look if they have the same kind of fielders, the same level of fielding, and that's not a very good fielding. All these adjustments give you all these different indices. All these things line up for DeGrom.
Oh,
it's all sabermetrics. But so the test really is, are you going to do it on the traditional basis? Because if you do it that way, Scherzer wins. But if you say, you know something, we're going to use statistics that people haven't even looked at before. They weren't invented more than 2 years ago. But that's the way baseball's going. Then DeGrom's going to win. So DeGrom's win would really reflect sort of a departure, really, a new direction for baseball and the acceptance of statistics, which had never been discussed before. But I actually think he is going to win. I think it's because of those new stats.
Question. Do they give a Cy Young Award for each league?
That's an interesting question.
Because all three of these people are in the same division of the same league.
The answer to that question is yes. They give a Cy Young Award winner. We're just talking about the Cy Young Award for the National League. But interesting that you point that out, because when I was growing up, there was only one Cy Young Award. And
is this an everybody gets a trophy thing?
I think so. In 1965 or so, they changed the rule to have one in each league. And the reason that I was conscious of that was because my favorite player, one of my favorite players in the Giants was Juan Marichal, who was the pitcher. And he was never able to win the Cy Young Award because it would go to a guy in the American League. It's just too much competition. They finally made it by league. And by that point, Sandy Koufax was dominating him, and he never won the Cy Young Award, even though he's one of the great pitchers in the history of baseball. But it is one for each league now. And we'll see if DeGrom wins and the stat guys, the sabermetrics guys, rule, which I think is going to happen.
So now you have kind of an art update.
Well, I had sort of something it's an art auction update. What would I know about an art auction? Because it has to do with comic books. Otherwise, I would have no idea. There is the original panels for a comic, which is called Master Race, which was penned in 1955. I had Bernie Krigstein is the name of the illustrator, and the writer is Al Feldstein. It struck me when I saw the panels in the paper, because I'm looking at it, it's 1955, and it's a compelling story. It certainly struck a chord at the time. It's about someone who's a Holocaust survivor who is on a subway, and he sees someone who was a Nazi commandant at one of the camps on the same subway.
In New York?
In New York. And I don't know the rest of the story, but apparently it's a striking story.
So these panels are up for auction at Heritage Auction House?
That's exactly right. And I was struck when I looked at it because I said, wow, that's 1955? Because that's a style I recognize as a very modern style, in particular a style I associate with Spider-Man and Marvel Comics in like the late 60s. I said this to you. You said to me, it doesn't look so modern to me.
But then I called Zeke.
The expert.
And first of all, Zeke had a hard time finding information about this comic book.
Right.
Because Google blocked it when he typed in Master Race.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, too.
That I thought was very interesting. But he managed to conjure up a few of the panels, and he said, wow, this guy is way ahead of his time.
Right.
In terms of the style of illustration.
Right.
But also, what you pointed out is that Neil Gaiman.
Right.
Actually posted comments about it.
Well, here's why. Because it's this is, again, being auctioned off. And the initial estimate of the auction price is $150,000. And so Neil Gaiman, who you can describe better than I can.
He's a famous writer of fantasy and mythology and quite a well-known author.
Right, an expert on Norse mythology in particular. And he put something on Twitter to alert everybody about this auction, and this is his quote. It's one of the most important stories in the history of comics and the history of art of comics. And therefore, he's posting the information about the auction in the hope that this gets bought by a museum, university, or a major library so people will be able to see it. So
that it won't be a private collection. Exactly. That people will have access to it.
Neil Gaiman notwithstanding, it's up for auction until November 15th. Anybody who has $150,000 and wants to invest in very valuable comic art can make
their
move.
Well, that's interesting on a lot of levels. That's all we've got today. It's been a wild and wonderful weekend.
Yes, it was an excellent podcast with Sadie, who always adds...
As usual.
Yes, as usual.
Glad you could join us.
Yeah, thank you.
Sadie. I won't be here next week, but I'll be here for Thanksgiving.
Yes, all right.
Okay.
We'll see how the pies come out.
Pies in hand.
I'm going to be working on one of these lattice pies.
I would just like to state for the record...
Why don't you stick with the herringbone?
The herringbone, that's where I'm going. Yes, Sadie.
Yeah, I would like a houndstooth pie, please.
A houndstooth?
Houndstooth. Yeah. Maybe some Blackwatch plaid.
Anyway, this is Tamsin Granger.
And Dan Abuhop.
With Tamsin and Dan read the paper.
And Sadie.
See you again next week.